stripped away his position as Bishop of Short Creek and forced him into hiding. At the age of 93 and in failing health, Fred had disappeared in the middle of the night, and he was said to have been sent on a special mission. Information about what had happened was sparse. People who had been at the house the night Fred was shuttled off told me that a crew had been assigned to remove his belongings. Things he could use the most, such as clothes, were left behind, while items of value that he had amassed over his long lifetime disappeared. Will Timpson, the new bishop, moved into the house the day after Fred disappeared. There are a lot of Jessups around, and the family tree is so strange that I did not find it unusual when I accompanied Joe C. Jessup, Jr., who is the combination son, grandson, and nephew of Uncle Fred, to the Washington County Sheriff's Office in the spring of 2005 so that he could file a report placing the former bishop into the National Criminal Identification Center's computerized federal database as a missing person. Other family members who were no longer in the FLDS were worried about him and feared he would not last long without appropriate medical care. Uncle Fred, who had personally known five of the nine prophets, was very sick, totally dependent on others, and cowed in his old age by Warren. He had been turned into a perfect yes-man, the ultimate loyalist, as his health failed.
"Uncle Warren is an Enoch. He is a Moses,"
Fred had praised in a sermon.
"He told us once he knew what Noah went through. He's a revelator like the prophet Joseph, a colonizer like Brigham Young, one who lives in hiding like John Taylor. All of those prophets are centered in Uncle Warren now."
That was about the highest endorsement anyone could give. As the months passed, Fred slipped so completely off our radar that I didn't know if he was alive or dead. Very few people did. Warren took a personal interest in the care of the ailing Uncle Fred, who was suffering from heart and kidney problems, was diabetic, and needed an oxygen tank to breathe. He insisted Fred's ladies were to give him only special bottled water, yarrow tea, and garlic drinks. Such instructions made it unclear to me whether Warren's intentions were meant to help or hurt the ailing old man. In early March 2005, hidden away in Texas by Warren, Fred's health took a turn for the worse. Two wives who were nursing him alerted the leadership, but instead of being immediately moved into a hospital, the frail old counselor was ordered to be driven to another hideaway in distant Albuquerque, New Mexico, about 9 grueling hours by car. The paranoid prophet wouldn't take the chance of that illness leading authorities back to Zion and ultimately to himself. According to Warren's journal, an FLDS doctor secured some medicine from prescriptions he wrote for people in Short Creek, and he was assigned the task of escorting Fred, along with two other couriers, on the cross-country journey that would surely end in the old man's death. Once they were settled in New Mexico, another wife pleaded that he be taken to a hospital immediately, and she was scolded for her lack of faith and for assuming to know more than the prophet, who was back in Texas, praying and ordering them to sit tight and wait to see whether Fred improved. Fred's inability to get medical attention was not unusual within the FLDS. It was never easy to get permission to go to a hospital, where a vulnerable patient would face questioning authorities and might inadvertently expose some sort of illegal activity back home. Permission had to come directly from Warren. But Fred was not the only thing on Warren's plate. Fresh off their eastern swing, he told Naomi that he was feeling the call to go to some foreign country and wanted maps of England, France, and Germany. While Fred was languishing in Albuquerque, Warren received another revelation, and the old man was put on the road again, transported farther north into Colorado, once again depriving the dying old man of much-needed medical attention. As the little convoy of two vehicles neared Denver, it seemed as if the venerable old church legend might die right there in the car. Permission finally was given to hospitalize him at the Sky Ridge Medical Center, about 20 miles from downtown Denver. He was placed in the intensive care unit, and the church's doctor, Lloyd Barlow, reported back to Warren periodically. Lloyd Barlow was later indicted in Texas for failure to report child abuse. The hospital staff was warned that Fred's only chance for survival was to have a stent surgically placed to stabilize his heart and then undergo arthroscopic surgery to repair a valve. About that time, Warren had another vision, which often happened when he needed to justify his actions. This one showed Uncle Fred getting into a car and going away to visit his family, but leaving Warren behind. The prophet was left with the impression that once Fred died and was on the other side of the veil, their work could continue faster than before. He instructed the doctors to make Fred as comfortable as possible, but to take no other medical actions. Warren decided to travel up from Texas to see Fred. At the hospital, he stood beside the dying man, who had a respirator down his throat. The doctors gave no hope without the surgery, which would have been performed at still another hospital, and was dangerous in any case for a patient in such poor health and at such an advanced age. Warren decided that his vision about the car was a sign from God to let Fred go. He coldly did not express any remorse for making the stricken man, who had been a loyal friend and follower for many years, travel hundreds of miles before allowing him to receive medical care. Once Uncle Fred passed away, the journal showed that Warren left in a hurry, because the Lord had shown him that if he stayed in Denver, he would be accused of killing the old man, and that as soon as the word got out, he would have the news media and also his enemies trying to trace the family. Next came the charade of a funeral. Fred had served his terrestrial usefulness to Warren, but he could continue to be a means of validating Warren's power. Will Timpson, now Will Jessup, who had replaced Fred as the bishop, lied to hospital administrators by saying that he was Fred's actual son and had authority to take possession of the body. He was allowed to haul the corpse away in the rear of an SUV to a hidden location. Colorado authorities considered filing criminal charges for illegally taking possession of a dead body and falsifying records, but they eventually gave up when jurisdictional problems cropped up because the Utah border had been crossed. Warren held some private moments with some of Fred's family at a secret hideaway, where he also decided details of the funeral and burial details to take place in Short Creek. The outlaw prophet then returned to the safety of Texas until the night before the funeral, when he jumped over to New Mexico, and a day later he and First Counselor Wendell Nielsen checked into an Albuquerque motel, which was as close as they would come to the funeral of their dear friend and Second Counselor, Frederick Meade Jessup in Short Creek. They did not show up personally, nor did the program contain their names. Even before the services started, the paranoid weirdness of the FLDS was on full display. The central hall at the Leroy S. Johnson Meeting House overflowed with the faithful on the balmy afternoon of Sunday, March 20, 2005. Technicians rigged transmissions to side rooms, to Albuquerque, into private homes, to Moncos, to the ranch in Texas, and all the way to Canada. Apostates who had known Uncle Fred for many years filtered up to the meeting house, but the bullies were ready. McRae Oler, a cocky young Canadian, was at the door to point out familiar faces from north of the 49th parallel, and those visitors were physically denied entrance. Big Willie Jessup wrenched the arm of one of Fred's relatives behind his back and shoved him out the door. Chief Marshal Sam Roundy blocked others in what Winston Blackmore later derisively described as special keep sweet moments. After the song, "Dear Uncle Fred, We Love You," Wendell Nielsen came on the speakerphone hookup and delivered an 11-minute tribute from the motel in New Mexico. Then, like the voice of a disembodied god, the unmistakable drone of Warren Jeffs drifted in. For the first time in more than a year, his Short Creek followers were hearing his actual voice and not a recording. He spoke for 30 minutes. In months to come, Jeffs would invoke the memory of the popular Uncle Fred to strengthen his hold, although his power was already complete. He was finally rid of the last real threat to his authority. Warren later would appoint an even stronger henchman, Merrill Jessup, to fill the vacancy left by the departed Uncle Fred in the first presidency. Adding up the tally later, It seems that the price Merrill paid to become so influential was the placement of at least 11 daughters and 2 granddaughters, some of whom were only underage children, to join Warren's long list of heavenly comfort wives. The only other truly important position in the FLDS Church was that of patriarch, to which Warren had appointed one of his own brothers, Leroy Jeffs. Warren began looking at him with suspicion. Chapter 25. 12 Years Old. Although Warren Jeffs had finally allowed Stephen Chatwin and his family to escape from the battleground home of his apostate brother Ross Chatwin, I suspected that the church still wasn't ready to give in. Ross had the building, but the court had said nothing about the utilities that served it, and the FLDS was always alert for an opening. The utilities were cut off, an intentionally cruel move since it was still bitterly cold in Short Creek. He had been heating the lower floor with a propane gas burner, but when Ross went to the city to change the water, gas, and electricity for the upper floor into his own name in March 2005, he was refused. The Chatwins went without utilities for nearly a month before the Hilldale City Council agreed to take up the matter in an emergency session. I drove down for the meeting and listened as Ross made a reasoned plea before the council members, all of whom were prominent FLDS members who detested him. I scribbled my name on a list of speakers to comment. I was not happy to hear them belittle Ross and his family as squatters on church land. They spoke in a self-righteous tone, even as they were depriving a couple with 6 young children of water, heat, and electricity in harsh weather. The council's hypocrisy was highlighted when the cell phone of Richard Allred, the Colorado City mayor, suddenly chirped out its custom ringtone, the familiar Mormon hymn, Love at Home. When my turn came to speak, I let them have it, lecturing them about religious persecution, civil rights violations, and the law. Chief Marshal Roundy, one of his deputies, and the ever-present enforcer Willie Jessup were staring daggers and closed in on me. But I ignored them, stood my ground, and said my piece. The previous day I had been out target shooting with my regular sidearm, and it wasn't until I arrived at the meeting that I realized I had left it at home to be cleaned. That was a careless mistake. I had learned that when dealing with the FLDS thugs, especially on their turf, it was prudent to be prepared for anything. The only weapon I had with me was my 6-pound Desert Eagle 44 Magnum, which I had also taken to target practice the day before, and I had tucked that huge hog-leg pistol beneath my jacket. It was uncomfortable and hard to hide. The Short Creek God Squad got close, but ended up hanging back, perhaps recognizing the distinctive imprint of the huge pistol. The council's rubber-stamped decision on behalf of the church was never in doubt. They voted unanimously to deny the utility hookups, just as Warren instructed. The situation was tense. As I left, the 3 goons were huddled together on the sidewalk in front of the council chambers, bragging about how they were going to take me down. Big Willie followed me out to the parking area and gave me his best death glare as I got into my car. He reminded me of a playground bully who had suddenly come face to face with someone who wasn't afraid of him. His juvenile tactics usually worked with the church members he was assigned to strong arm, but seemed comical to me. I decided there was still one more thing that I could try to do to help the Chatwins with their problem. Later that day, I telephoned every media contact I had, and the reporters deluged the city offices and Mayor David Zitting with questions about why the church had terminated the needed city-run services to a desperate family of 8 in their own home. With a court order in place, outside law enforcement agencies becoming curious, and the media breathing down his neck, Warren decided not to continue that particular fight. The utilities were turned back on before sunset. It was a minor victory for us, but it felt good to put still another one in the win column. Leroy Jeffs did not last another month as the patriarch of the church. Warren heard that some FLDS people were turning to his more approachable brother for counsel because they did not know how to access the prophet. A dream soon followed in which God revealed to Warren that Leroy was no longer worthy of priesthood. Warren telephoned his brother the very next morning and stripped him of his title, wives, children, and home, although Leroy was allowed to continue working as an accountant for the prophet and in the businesses of David Allred, the purchaser of the FLDS refuge lands. Warren's thoughts were raging. He had a mountain of things to think about and decisions to make, and his word alone mattered. His thrashing dreams grew wilder. They could be about something as simple as detecting a lack of faith in an errant member, a routine piece of church business, or a decision to forbid FLDS kids from eating Gentile candy. But he also had apocalyptic visions, such as fleeing to Europe and leading invading armies back to America. After telling his scribe that they were about to face the greatest destruction that has ever been on this land or on the face of the earth, he would then easily slide right back to planning a landscape of roses and shade trees for the Texas compound and the type of crown molding needed around the temple walls. According to Naomi, just before dawn on Monday, April 11, 2005, Warren uttered an emphatic,
"Wow. Whatever you say. Yes, sir."
The Lord had just told him to collect a pure, innocent girl to add to his fold. A little later, he identified her as Brenda Fisher, the eldest daughter of Wayne Fisher, and, as Naomi recorded, the prophet asked and answered in his sleep,
"How old is she?" "She is 12.
Warren dispatched another of his brothers, Seth Jeffs, his most trusted courier, to Short Creek to fetch Wayne and his preteen daughter to Texas, along with some $200,000 in fresh greenbacks. Wayne Fisher apparently was less than enthusiastic that his child had been chosen at such a tender age, and he and his little girl had to endure Seth playing recordings of Warren's hypnotic training throughout the long drive to Texas. Warren kept in touch with Seth by telephone and told him to take an even longer route so that Wayne and his daughter would have more time to listen to the mind-numbing lectures and read booklets of selected sermons. Warren required that both child and father sign agreements to keep the sacred nature of their journey secret.
"It is just marvelous," Warren told his scribe. "The Lord is choosing young girls who can be worked with and easily taught."
He personally drove the Fishers around the ranch for 90 minutes on Saturday afternoon, and he spent time alone with Wayne until the man finally gave in and wept his approval for his little girl to be handed over. The prophet married 12-year-old Brenda at 9 o'clock that night, only a few days after picking her out in a dream. The incident, recorded by Naomi in the journal in its troubling entirety, wiped out any doubt that FLDS men only married women who were consenting adults. It was child rape, over and over, and it took place across interstate boundaries in violation of the U.S. White Slave Traffic Act, the Mann Act of 1910. I was starting to wonder why the feds had made such a dismal showing on cases like this that were so obviously a slam dunk. I knew that they were aware of human trafficking within the FLDS, and yet, after showing interest, they would fade away, accomplishing nothing. On April 13th, I was in the Texas State Capitol in Austin, along with John Krakauer and others, to testify before a legislative committee in support of a bill to raise the legal age of marriage, which at the time was only 14. That had been one reason the FLDS had zeroed in on El Dorado in the first place. "By God, this is Texas, and we do not tolerate child abuse in this state. Child abusers go to prison for a long time here." An old legislator barked at me, apparently thinking I had some sort of control over such matters. I was not the one he should have been attacking, but he was showing the right spirit. Utah Attorney General Mark Shurtleff also appeared as a witness, and he admitted that law enforcement in his state had dragged their feet in the prosecution of polygamists who had taken child brides. He pleaded with the Texas legislators not to make the same mistakes that had been made in Utah. The Texas legislators not only raised the age of consent in their state to 17, but also strengthened penalties for child abuse and bigamy in the commission of other crimes. That squarely put the polygamists at the YFZ ranch on notice that marrying a child could mean a long prison term. In the years to come, that legislation would pay huge dividends in the prosecution of FLDS members, including the prophet Warren Jeffs himself. Chapter 26, Grand Jury. We hope that the deep hatred Candy Shapley felt for her abusive ex-husband, Randy Barlow, would propel her forward to the witness stand despite some misgivings. Trust was key to getting her there. Although we kept everything very hush-hush to prevent her family and the church from finding out, no secret can hold indefinitely. So Candy was put on the fast track to lock in her testimony. She was so fragile and unaccustomed to dealing with the outside world that she was having a problem responding to the brusque law enforcement manner of Gary Ingalls. I altered my approach. While Gary pushed the case to the next level criminally in Arizona, I used a softer tone, sitting quietly for long spells while she showed me photographs of her wedding day and gradually opened up, revealing more details. Finally, Gary had enough evidence to take to his boss, Matt Smith, the aggressive Mojave County prosecutor, who launched the procedure for a grand jury appearance in Kingman. Once again, the state lines got in the way. Candy kept her focus, and by early June 2005, only about 8 weeks after our initial conversation on April 2nd, everything was in place. I met with Candy and her sister Tammy to talk them through the process and provide a realistic understanding of what to expect. I knew it was going to be tough on Candy, and I wanted to minimize any surprises. Since Candy had already been booted out of the FLDS, she had nothing to lose on that front, but she still had great concerns. One of her questions was, "Am I going to have to testify against Warren?" I knew that she might balk at that possibility, because it exposed her to being castigated by almost everyone she knew as a traitor who was trying to bring down the prophet. I replied honestly that she might have to do that at some point, and that plenty of people would be around to help when that time came. "For now," I said, "concentrate on Randy." Candy had another major worry. One of her twin daughters had been born with serious birth defects and required virtually constant care, a challenge for anybody. There was a last-minute delay when her child was rushed to Primary Children's Hospital in Salt Lake for emergency treatment, and her testimony was postponed until the baby was stable. Finally, she and Tammy were comfortable to go, boarding a small plane sent to Salt Lake City by the Mojave County Sheriff's Office. Neither had been on an airplane before, and they were as excited as if it were an amusement park ride. They flew across the border from Utah and into Arizona, and on June 8th, in Kingman, Candy Shapley delivered her testimony before the grand jury in a firm voice and without hesitation, not only responding to the questions, but expanding on her answers. She was articulate and accurate and knew exactly what she was doing, and was so convincing that the grand jury not only hit Barlow on charges of rape and unlawful sexual conduct, but also indicted Warren Jeffs on 2 sixth-degree felony counts of sexual conduct with a minor and 1 charge of conspiracy to commit sexual conduct with a minor. Candy had come through. The prophet was now wanted not only on the civil charges, but on criminal charges that could mean several years in prison. I slept a lot easier that night. This had been the game changer I had sought for so long. It held out hope that in the future, other girls finding themselves in a similar predicament might understand that some sort of recourse was available. I was proud of Candy. The secrecy of a grand jury room is supposed to be inviolable. Even I did not know what had been said in that proceeding. I was counting on that secrecy and had been working with Gary Ingalls and John Krakauer to alert the various arms of law enforcement that an indictment and an arrest warrant might be coming down. Now the law would really be looking for Jeffs. It would no longer be a figment of his imagination. The grand jury had met on Wednesday, June 8th. The indictments were handed down on Thursday, June 9th, and the results were leaked almost immediately. By Friday, June 10th, I was swamped by media calls. I couldn't believe it. I asked Gary what had happened. At that point, he was pretty cavalier about it, saying that prosecutor Matt Smith had decided to go ahead and break the news. "That was a huge mistake," I told my old friend. Our goal of keeping the police informed and ready in case Warren started to move collapsed. I hung up and tried to contact Candy. Her phone went straight to voicemail, as if it was shut off or she was out of range. I spent the next day contacting her friends in the refugee subculture, but no one had heard from her. She was gone. It had only taken the FLDS a matter of hours to connect the dots and figure out who had testified against the Prophet. Gary and I spent the next week trying to locate her, but were unable to find a thing. Our star witness was in the wind, and I was worried sick. Gary Ingalls was so devastated by her disappearance that he considered resigning. I was sweating bullets, because that was the last thing I wanted. A veteran cop, Gary was a fine investigator and a good friend, and without him, we would never have had Candy testifying in the first place. We had been through way too much together to let something like this leak get in the way of our friendship, and besides, it wasn't his fault. So we did what we had always done and got back to work. A couple weeks later, as I was leaving my office to go home, fumbling for my car keys, my cell phone rang. It was Candy, and she sounded like a changed woman. I listened to her with deep disappointment. The church had gotten to her. She explained that she had gone away on a camping trip with her father, Bill Shapley. Out there in the wilderness, Bill had helped her understand what was happening and why Uncle Warren was forced to do the things that he was doing, because the government was wrongfully accusing him of crimes and wanted to lock him up and maybe even kill him. She would not testify against him in a trial. She had changed her mind about Randy, too, because he had a wife and kids, and she did not want to hurt them. As the familiar robotic words came out of her mouth, it was all I could do to keep from snapping, "Candy, have you lost your mind?" But that would have gotten us nowhere. She also felt betrayed by Gary and Matt. I had to keep the thin line of communication open, to try to reestablish the trust, because she was too important to lose. Any diatribe on my part would just push her away, so I held my temper and we spoke for a while about other topics to settle the waters. I did ask her to consider the fact that her father previously had been kicked out of the church by Warren, but had suddenly been readmitted, and his family reinstated after she came forward as a witness. She knew how rare that was. She brushed it off. Her father was a good and humble man who had successfully completed the repentance process. I didn't buy that for a minute, but she badly wanted to believe it, and I just had to let it go. After hanging up, I knew that it would be another long tightrope walk to get her back on a witness stand. I could imagine what she was going through. She was a 19-year-old single mom trying to raise twins, one of whom was severely handicapped. She had run from a violent, forced marriage, only to have to deal with the harsh realities of the real world. Her parents had abandoned her, but like most abused and neglected kids, she still loved her family. The camping trip was probably her first real communication with her father since he had been ordered not to be part of her life, and her mother also had suddenly shown up to help care for the children. Although nothing but a ploy on the part of the church, the fact that her family was back in her life was a godsend to Candy in her weak emotional state. It was the closest she had been to them since being ostracized with the scarlet letter of an adulteress. It came as no surprise to learn that behind the scenes, Warren had made some pretty shrewd countermoves upon finding out that Candy was cooperating with authorities. He decided that her father, Bill Shapley, had repented enough to return to the FLDS, and that four of his wives could be resealed to him. Shapley jumped at the opportunity. Warren had reached Bill, and Bill had now reached Candy. But the prophet dug his heels in about another wife, Esther, who was Candy's mother. She was out of the family and would stay out, although she wanted above all things to be back in. She was not allowed to go back to her former husband and was only given a meager widow's stipend and allowed to share a trailer with other so-called widows. That desire provided more leverage for Warren to control her, and his fate might depend upon the ability of Bill and Esther Shapley to control their rebellious daughter. Watching the Arizona situation closely was a potential witness of equal importance in Utah, Elissa Wall. While I had been focusing on Candy, Elissa had established some friendly but loose communication with our attorney, Roger Houle. After Candy's name was leaked to the press and the FLDS hit back hard, the pregnant Elissa recoiled. She wanted no part of a similar experience, so Roger simply kept the lines of communication open with Elissa and her boyfriend, Lamont Barlow. It turned out that the Mojave County Prosecutor's Office wasn't the only one to leak the news of Jeff's indictment. On his own, Sheriff David Doran had gone to the YFZ Ranch at 4:45 on the afternoon of June 10th to meet with Merrill Jessup. He thought there was a possibility that Warren was there, and he told the bishop about the grand jury's decision, requesting that the prophet surrender peacefully. Merrill shrugged and again lied that he had no idea where Warren was. Hadn't seen him for months. Jeffs, meanwhile, was lurking nearby behind the walls of R-17, monitoring the situation and waiting for Jessup to finish hustling the sheriff and report back. So Doran had unwittingly beaten Mojave County in leaking the information, and not to the press, but straight to the people we most wanted to stay in the dark. When Jessup delivered the news of the indictment, the prophet panicked. I've seen this kind of reaction numerous times, when people learn that charges have been filed against them but have no idea of the details. Their thoughts go to their darkest secrets. If Warren followed this pattern, his thoughts would have been about a life of fraud, ritualistic sexual abuse of little girls, using young boys as slave labor, raping children of both sexes, robbing men of their possessions, and reassigning wives. Who had sold him out? Was it his brother Leroy, whom he had disgraced, misused, and expelled? My clients had told me that Leroy had witnessed Warren's sexual assaults back at the academy, but may not have participated. Had Leroy gone to the government as revenge for being thrown out of the church? Or perhaps Mother Mary had finally turned traitor? The sister of Warren's bitter enemy, apostate Dan Fisher, and a registered nurse, Mary had tended Uncle Rulon, her husband, around the clock during the last months of his life. She had seen the fear in Rulon's eyes as he realized he was about to die. Warren would tell the faithful that Father's last words were, "Oh my God." Mary knew differently. I interviewed one of the medical staff who was present and another of Rulon's wives, and they both confirmed that in his last moment, Rulon actually had looked into the eyes of his maniacal son and said, "Oh my God. What have I done?" Warren had decided to take Mary, his stepmother, as one of his first brides after the death of the old man. She appeared to be so disoriented by what was unfolding around her that she stood up and proclaimed Warren to be the dead prophet's choice for the job. Still, he did not trust her, because she knew too much. Whenever Warren felt his enemies might be closing in, Mother Mary would be moved to a new, secret location to keep her in the shadows. Leroy and Mother Mary were the goblins he feared most, but the irrational Warren Jeffs had been lashing out in all directions. He was certain that traitors existed even among his closest friends, so everyone was on thin ice. His most stalwart goon, Willie Jessup, was pointedly asked if he was riding both sides of the fence. Money man David Allred was under suspicion for making business deals without the prophet's approval. God warned Warren that some of his wives were falling away, and his own children were told to straighten up or be dispatched to where the disobedient people are. He was ready to kick out anybody. For the next 3 days, the YFZ Ranch was in a frenzy. Instead of building, they were destroying potential evidence, letters, financial records, family photo albums, and computer disks were trashed. According to the priesthood record, Warren's brother Lyle provided him with some details of the grand jury episode. His version of the episode, that is. Lyle said that the Attorney General of Utah, Mark Shurtleff, had swooped down on Candy Shapley in Salt Lake City, confronted her, handcuffed her, and carted her off to the airport. Lyle reported that the main question the grand jury asked was, "Did Warren Jeffs perform this marriage ceremony?" And she said, "Yes." It was all an ambitious lie, because Lyle had no knowledge of how we had dealt so gently with Candy, nor did he know what was said within the grand jury room. Shurtleff had never seen or spoken with her. Lyle made up the tale to please his brother. It was up to Warren to explain to the anxious temple workers that danger was knocking at the gates. He had them gather for a circle prayer that was of such significance that even Uncle Fred was invited to participate from beyond the grave. But Warren chickened out at the last minute. Before he was to speak, he smiled at Merrill Jessup and whispered, "God wants us to leave right now." With that, the paranoid prophet grabbed Naomi, his first counselor, Wendell Nielsen, and his brother and driver, Isaac, and they all took off for Austin, Texas, and beyond that, to points unknown. His special hand-chosen temple workers were left in his dust, bewildered and abandoned. Chapter 27. On the Road. With little money and few friends and a circumscribed existence, most fugitives find hiding to be hard work. But Warren Jeffs was not the usual fugitive. He had a network of believers that stretched all the way across America, thousands of people who saw it as an honor and a privilege to give the pedophile prophet shelter, money, literally anything they had, with total loyalty and no questions asked. Many of the numerous places of refuge were not extravagant like R-17 in Texas, but simply modest family homes dotted somewhere on his map of safe havens. When he had first started traveling incognito around the country, he had been rather modest about his disguises. As he became more adept at hiding in the world of the Gentiles, he became almost brazen in his taste for the good life. He was no longer satisfied with just putting on a hat and telling his driver not to exceed the speed limit. Like everything else in his life, the traveling was carried to the extreme, almost as if Warren were an addict chasing the big rush. Warren and Naomi had dashed from Texas to Oklahoma to Colorado to Washington State, and from Sacramento to Fresno, California, before looping down through Las Vegas and heading east to Florida. Before leaving each place, Warren took time to raise his arm to the square and condemn it to the judgments of God as a curse for the wickedness he had found. By the end of June 2005, he was in deep cover at the Hilton Garden Inn in Pensacola, Florida, sprawled in the sunshine on a sandy beach. Naomi was at his side, her hair dyed the color of chocolate, with red highlights. Both wore bathing suits as they happily watched the other near-naked bodies around them. Warren reported that he was pleasing the Lord.
"In this amazing experience of being unclothed, suntanning, dressing like the world, with only a swimsuit on."
He had bought a year's worth of new contact lenses. His hair was trimmed, and he was starting a mustache. One of the church-run businesses had just sent him $15,500 for spending money, along with a sparkling new Porsche Cayenne. At night, he and Naomi watched television and movies in the hotel room and appeared to be feigning disgust at the pornography as they avidly scrutinized each scene.
"They displayed the open, corrupt sexual actions one with another," he said. "Men with women, women with women, as though it is the delight and way of life."
During the day, he would sit in the Porsche, turn the air conditioning on full blast, and phone detailed instructions back to his followers as he checked on the temple work. The Lord had instructed him on landscaping, the types of flowers, grass, and trees to be planted. Nothing escaped divine scrutiny. He used prepaid, throwaway cell phones routed through complex dock and talk networks as his main means of communication, but bags of mail containing letters of support and plenty of cash for him were waiting at rendezvous points. Warren would often slit open the envelopes to extract the cash, and often appeared to have set aside the confessions of repentance unread, at least until he could take sufficient time to savor the transgressions and figure out how best to use the secrets to control the writers. The man who tried so hard to avoid attention was, however, totally contradictory on that point when it came to cars. He loved Hot Wheels, and he rolled into the Texas compound one day driving a bright yellow Ford Mustang convertible. Faithful followers obtained flashy vehicles for him, which they would register in their own names, to help Warren roam. He was partial to expensive SUVs, and had been known to travel in a Porsche, a BMW, and a Mercedes-Benz. He even, for a while, had a couple of fiery red Harley-Davidson motorcycles, with fancy biker dude leathers and accessories, and a picture shows a motorcycle parked with him astride the big machine and Naomi behind him. But looks can be deceiving. The physically weak prophet never mastered the heavy $50,000 Harley and was a failure as a biker. It eventually was stolen, but Warren did not report the theft because the police would have become involved. The indictment on criminal charges following Candy Shapley's testimony apparently was the prophet's ticket to party, as no other FLDS member had ever done. He used it as an excuse to gallivant around the country and live a life that was not possible inside of the FLDS compounds. He had escaped not only from the law, but from the horrendously oppressive rules that he imposed on everyone else. Warren paid a Negro woman in California $250 to braid Naomi's hair in plaited cornrows. When other wives joined him on the road, they also wore jeans and tops and sweaters and sported new hairstyles. Tooling along in a new SUV with pretty young wives made up like Gentiles at his side, eluding the cops, keeping the flock scared to death with pronouncements of doom, directing the building of his temple at R-17, and still managing all of the affairs of the church, expelling men and conducting underage marriages, lifted him to the status of a cult hero among the believers. His FLDS acolytes thought the way that the prophet outwitted his enemies was great fun. The mysterious road trip of Warren Jeffs, fueled by his inner ferocity for secrecy, would continue for many months and take him from the Gentile amusement park called Disneyland in California, through the heart of Dixie, up to the rocky coast of Maine, across the prairies, and into the mountains. He lived in hotels and motels or secret refuge houses, or he might just show up unannounced at the home of a sympathizer. By far, his most preferred stop was the YFZ Ranch in Texas, where he could be smuggled in and out and secrecy and protection were assured. Eventually, he felt that even the United States might be too small for him, that he might not be able to outrun his mounting troubles. He dyed his own hair and went shopping with Naomi in a Dallas mall to buy expensive clothes for going among the rich in Europe. He charged his lieutenants with getting false identification papers and passports that would allow him to escape to foreign lands. Obtaining authentic-looking documentation proved to be impossible, and although the negotiators spent freely, they were afraid that the underworld characters with whom they were dealing would double-cross them. They ultimately failed, and Warren eventually called off his plans for Europe, deciding that he would just have to be more careful. He had good reason to remain paranoid and on the run. Each passing month seemed to bring him more bad news. Although Winston Blackmore and I disagreed about polygamy and other issues, we had learned to work together and had earned each other's trust. Now, That careful maintenance of Blackmore as a source paid a huge dividend when a what-if brainstorming session between us resulted in a devastating move against the United Effort Plan Trust. Warren Jeffs was still president of the UEP, a position that gave him total control over who could stay on trust-owned lands and who must go. Blackmore and I reasoned that if an FLDS follower wished to willingly turn his home over to the church, that should be a personal decision. But nearly all the families in Short Creek had built their home on UEP-owned land and had lived there for years and were considered to be only tenants in common, beneficiaries of the UEP Trust, by the church. Then there was an additional group, those who had been expelled by the church but flatly refused to move out. We felt that all of the residents deserved the right to choose whether or not to live in their homes and not to have the church arbitrarily making that decision. Thousands of people and millions of dollars in assets were involved. So Winston and I kicked around some ideas during a 3-hour telephone conversation. I was parked in Utah with my cell plugged into the car, and Winston was on a swather in Canada, doing the first cut of spring hay. We wondered if there might be some way to replace Warren, who was on the lam, and the trustees, with a new board of directors comprising a fair representation of all beneficiaries of the trust. The reorganization would strip the church of its arbitrary power and allow individuals to make pertinent choices regarding their homes, something stronger than the life estate granted to the Chatwins and a few others. Ironically, it was Warren himself who had opened the possibility of a reorganization through his beloved Answer Them Nothing legal strategy. Since he had disappeared, the trust was being mismanaged and lay at risk of losing all its assets. With Warren not answering the lawsuits, if our clients chose to take a default judgment by the court, they could seize anything of value belonging to the trust beneficiaries. They could have become rich. But their intent all along had not been to make a lot of money in a lawsuit. They wanted to deny Warren Jeffs the use of the trust as leverage to kick their families out of the community by taking their homes and everything they had. The prophet could not have it both ways. He either had to appear in public and answer the charges in court, or he would remain silent and in hiding and lose. It gave our clients the unique opportunity to pursue home ownership for all of the beneficiaries of the trust. I ran our conversation by Roger Houle, who had taken over from Pat Shea as our Utah counsel, and he consulted with the Utah Attorney General's office. They concluded that if such a charitable trust was not being managed properly, then the state could step in to protect the rights of the beneficiaries. A special fiduciary could be appointed, and a court could assume control until it was all settled. On May 27th, 3rd District Judge Robert Adkins issued a temporary restraining order that suspended the power and authority of the United Effort Plan Trust. The prophet went ballistic. His piousness had boomeranged, and by maintaining silence, he was sure to lose the legal challenge, thus surrendering control of the wealth represented by the UEP lands in the United States and Canada. He concluded that the devil was behind the attack because God had absolutely ordered him to tell the courts nothing. He instructed his UEP board members to ignore the courts until forced to give up. Then, he predicted, the faithful could expect to be driven from their homes, perhaps even killed, and if they survived, they would be scattered across the nation to live in rented homes among the Gentiles. It was still another test from God, he said. When all else failed, Warren could always place the blame with God as a test of faith. When Ross Chatwin's brother Andrew learned that the UEP Trust was no longer under the control of the prophet, he decided to come home again. As a boy, he had attended the sadistic Alta Academy, where he had gotten Warren Jeffs in trouble by tattling about being whipped badly by the sadistic schoolmaster. Uncle Rulon was still alive at the time and allowed Andrew to go unpunished. When Andrew turned 18, he was given a piece of UEP land on which to build a home so he could start a family. Not being one to forgive and forget, Warren exacted revenge when he became the prophet's mouthpiece. He ran Andrew out of town. Now Andrew was diabetic, having trouble continuing to work in the construction trades. Money was tight, and his kids were getting ready for school. Since the house he had built from the ground up in Short Creek stood empty, but was being maintained by his father, he thought he could move back in and live without the burden of any house payments. The FLDS hierarchy saw it differently. They were not about to allow this apostate, his Gentile wife, and their three kids to move in among the chosen ones. Afraid that he would be the brunt of Warren's revenge, Andrew's father had forewarned church authorities that his son would be moving in. When they arrived with their belongings, Andrew found the police blocking the driveway. And the church had suddenly moved another of his brothers, Sam Chatwin, into the house that very day. Still determined to live in Short Creek, Andrew found an alternative. The trust manager would allow him to claim another house of equal value as long as it was empty, so he wasn't displacing any other family. Andrew found a potential candidate on a list of properties, and he started moving in, with the help of friends and other castaways. The police soon showed up there, too, and a standoff developed. The refugees captured everything on video cameras, and the scenes are still disturbing to anyone unfamiliar with FLDS radicalism. I was called on the phone to give what advice I could, and the usual theme played out. The cops were told this was a civil matter, that they had no authority, and that Andrew had obtained legal permission to occupy the dwelling. The cops ignored them. Throughout the day and into the evening, more police cars rolled up, as did a fleet of automobiles and pickup trucks driven by other FLDS men. The Mojave County Sheriff's Office was called, and within a few hours, an Arizona deputy arrived. He did what any law enforcement agency would normally do. He refused to get involved in a civil dispute because no crime had been committed. The deputy made a report and advised the local police not to meddle in property disputes involving private parties. The local cops pretended to agree, and the crowd drifted away. As soon as the deputy cleared out for his five-hour drive back to Kingman, the local police and vigilantes returned. About midnight, Chief Marshal Sam Roundy looked out at the gathered throng and turned to his brother, Deputy Marshal Jonathan Roundy, to ask, "So are we going to do this?" Jonathan replied, "Let's do it." There was a burst of movement, and from the darkness emerged a throng of about 75 men, tramping in military unison with their hands clasped behind their backs. Uncle Rulon had created an organization that he christened the Sons of Helaman, after a figure in distant Mormon history who had fathered valiant offspring. Present-day FLDS boys were trained like soldiers and learned, among other things, how to march. Warren would eventually expand their role to form a network of spies and snitches within the community. The Sons of Helaman reminded me of similar familiar youth groups. Upon reaching the house, the silent advancing column encircled it with a closed perimeter. Immediately, a herd of work crews with pickup trucks and small bobcat tractors swooped out of nowhere. Colorado City Refuse Department drivers backed up their trash trucks in the middle of the night. Chief Marshal Sam Roundy threatened Andrew Chatwin with arrest if he did not stand aside, then stalked directly into the house to direct the vigilante raid and actually help remove the Chatwin's furniture. FLDS work crews got to work, stacking all of the family's belongings out on the street, then attacked the house and gutted it. Little kids helped haul drywall and build an 8-foot-high fence. Other cops tracked down the former occupant, who had moved across town and into a nicer home to accommodate his growing family 2 years earlier. Now he was brought back, and he claimed to only have left the place empty temporarily for some remodeling. The crews worked for 4 days straight, totally rebuilt the rundown house, and then moved the absentee family back in, all under the watchful eyes of the local police. Not a shot was fired during this all-out assault by an unfeeling church against a single family trying to find a home. The relentless intimidation, the outright disregard for the law, and the clear threat of violence was more than enough to get the job done. It was unbelievably frustrating for me to watch them repeatedly disobey the law and get away with it. There was just nobody to stop them in the isolated place called Short Creek. It was the FLDS way. On June 22, 2005, the courts came through. A judge in Utah, the Honorable Denise Lindberg, suspended all the known trustees of the United Effort Plan Trust, including Warren, his brother Leroy, and Short Creek Bishop William Timpson Jessup. In an accompanying step, Salt Lake City Certified Public Accountant Bruce Weissen was appointed by the court as a special fiduciary to oversee UEP property and protect the trust assets. That would mean that people living in houses they had built on UEP land could no longer legally be thrown into the street at the whim of the prophet, a significant tear in his armor of invincibility. Andrew, who had found temporary shelter in the home of an uncle, obtained Weissen's help to get a court order that would allow him back into the home he had built. An eviction notice was posted, and his brother Sam abruptly left. Andrew and his family live there today. On July 12th, a little more than a month after Warren was indicted, Arizona brought charges against 8 Short Creek FLDS men on various charges in connection with the practice of forced underage marriages. Among them was Randy Barlow, whose ex-concubine, Candy Shapley, had testified against him before a Mojave County grand jury. Another was Rodney Holm, the decertified former FLDS deputy marshal who had been convicted in Utah for marrying a 16-year-old girl and was now facing the same charge in Arizona. The very next day, Arizona and Utah each posted a $5,000 reward for information leading to Warren Jeff's arrest. Although I thought the reward was a positive move, the amount was, in my opinion, nowhere near enough to persuade any FLDS loyalist to drop a dime on Warren. To rat out the prophet meant the informer would likely lose everything, including home, job, and family, in addition to being totally shunned by the rest of the hive. As horrible as the crick might be for them, living there was easier than getting on all alone in a mysterious world they had never learned to comprehend. Any active FLDS member with the guts to come out against Warren would need a lot of resources to start a completely new life, and the $10,000 total being offered was nowhere near enough to make that kind of sacrifice. As I expected, no one stepped forward. In August, Arizona Attorney General Terry Goddard moved to force the Colorado City Unified School District into state receivership for gross mismanagement. About 1,200 students were enrolled in public schools back in the year 2000 when Warren Jeffs decided to remove all of the FLDS kids from the district because the curriculum allegedly was an abomination to God. In reality, the move was just another money-making scheme to profit from the Gentiles. The FLDS kids would be homeschooled instead, leaving only a sampling of students who were mostly from nearby Centennial Park, the community that had broken away from the FLDS and no longer followed Jeff's. This reduced the student body to about 400 children. But there was no accompanying slash in the payroll for the more than 100 employees and 18 administrators. Nearly all of the teachers, administrators, groundskeepers, and maintenance personnel were FLDS members and kept their jobs, drawing salaries from the taxpayers. The resulting out-of-whack ratio of about 3 students to every teacher in the system continued to funnel public funds into the FLDS community. Steadfast Warrenite, Alvin Barlow, was the longest-tenured public school superintendent on record in Arizona and had been amply rewarded for his tenure. While bouncing teacher payroll checks, the district went into debt by almost $2 million, but bought its own airplane for $250,000 and supplied loyal FLDS administrators with new SUVs and pickups, phones, and computers. It was a bizarre and convoluted scheme that began before I started my investigation, for which I was thankful. I did not need that on my plate, too. But for Arizona Attorney General Terry Goddard to intervene on the old issue of the schools at this particular time gave Warren Jeff something else to worry about. The various government agencies that ignored him for so long were awakening. The Prophet, on the run and hiding out, stayed just ahead of the approaching storms. I still did not know where he was. That did not mean that I was idle, though. Far from it. I was staying in touch with Candy in hopes of convincing her how important her testimony in court would be to other young girls who were coming of age on the FLDS bridal farms. But she was no longer the only bullet in the gun. In July, after a quiet meeting in Baltimore with Joanne Suter, the courageous Alyssa Wall chose to get involved. "I didn't want to pull any punches in my efforts to get Warren," she would later write in her best-selling autobiography, Stolen Innocence. "I had been at a conference in Mesquite, Nevada that summer when Brock Belknap, the Washington County prosecutor located in St. George, Utah, had pulled me aside. He had received a tip that we may have found a solid new witness who might be willing to testify against the FLDS leader and said, 'If there's something criminal involved in this, let me know.'" Now it was time. Roger Houle placed a call to Belknap, and he started an investigation, working closely with Alyssa and protecting her identity to avoid FLDS obstruction in the case, as they had done with Candy. Then, another break. At 3 o'clock in the morning on October 28, 2005, Seth Steed Jeffs, the road-running courier brother of the Prophet, was lying on a mattress in the back of a Ford Excursion SUV driven by Nathaniel Allred when police pulled them over in Pueblo County, Colorado, expecting to find a drunk driver. Inside the vehicle, the cops found a cache of unusual material: a laptop, letters addressed to the Prophet, church records, $142,000 in cash, some $7,000 in prepaid debit and phone cards, along with a GPS and a glass jar bearing the label, "Pennies for the Prophet," and a photo of Warren Jeffs, a gift from the FLDS children. Both Jeffs and Allred were arrested. The frightened Allred was scared to death, consumed with fear about going to a Gentile jail, and with guilt for having accompanied his cousin on the trip. The savvy deputy advised the young man that honesty might buy him a break, but lying would most certainly buy him some jail time. That was all it took. Nate told police that Seth had paid him $5,000 to accompany him on the road trip and have sex with him. Jeff stonewalled police, claiming he did not know the Prophet's location, and said, "Even if I did know, I wouldn't reveal the information to you." Charges against Allred were dropped in exchange for his cooperation, but prosecutors wanted federal prison time for the Prophet's sibling. Seth Jeffs was charged with soliciting prostitution and harboring a fugitive. A plea deal was reached for Seth to plead guilty to harboring a fugitive, and the soliciting prostitution charges would be dropped. The final word lay with a naive federal judge who moralized that he would not visit the sins of the brother, Warren, upon Seth Jeffs. Seth got off with a slap-on-the-wrist sentence of 3 years probation and a $2,500 fine. It seemed straight out of the FLDS playbook. Seth Jeffs, who had been caught aiding and abetting his fugitive brother, fell on his sword and took a hit for God and the Prophet, with no real scars to show for it. He was now a martyr for the cause, and to an FLDS man, it doesn't get much better than that. Shortly after his early release from probation, he appeared on Oprah from the Texas compound, where he was regarded as a hero. His appearance was scripted by church leaders, and he gave the TV crew the old Red Cross and the concentration camp tour of the ranch. He criticized the persecution of his church and showed off 7 of his wives and 19 children. When asked if he thought a young girl should enter into a marriage or spiritual union, Seth opined that it was her choice. "Who really cares?" he asked. I was frustrated by his bluster, by the apathy displayed by the federal courts, and by the misleading impression left with Oprah's television audience. I was more interested in how Seth had screwed up, made a mistake, and gotten caught out on the roads. Warren, under growing pressure, just might do the same thing. Chapter 28. The Turf War. The Candy Shapley situation became increasingly bizarre after her grand jury testimony. Her emotions were all over the map as she found herself caught between enormous pressure from the church and her family, and her legal obligations.